Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
FX Guide is proudly sponsored by SIGGRAPH Asia. FX Podcast is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia, this year being held in Hong Kong, December 12th to 15th. For more information, go to siggraph.org/asia2011.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast from IBC 2011 Amsterdam. John Montgomery with you, along with Jeff. How's it going, my friend?
Hey, it's all good. Happy to be here.
Also brought in someone else for our square table here at the picnic table at the beach, Simon Blackledge. Simon, how's it going?
It's going well. It's going well.
Appreciate hearing from Simon in the past. I may recognize him from last year. I think we were having a pint at the pub, and now we're having a pint at the beach, which is a nice sandy area to relax and get off that.
And the sun is out.
Which has been unusual at this trip in Amsterdam.
Yeah, it's been in and out ever since we got here. It's been rainy and overcast, and then it'll be beautiful for a while. And right now we're hitting one of those beautiful passes, so...
So what we thought we'd do is kind of go over some highlights from the show, maybe expand in a bit more detail some of the things that we covered in our online article, I guess. But I don't know, Simon, I just want to kind of get your take on something that came out on Friday, which is the big news from the Foundry regarding the Hero workflow and EDL product. Basically, the idea is kind of almost a workstation to prep and conform EDLs. I'm asking you those kinds of things you need to do when you conform and get it all prepped out and ready to go. But interesting thing, they still haven't mentioned pricing about it.
No, I'd be interested to see the price and whether they actually do something that could sit on every artist's machine, as well as like a hero version.
Right.
You know, like a super user version that could control the in and outs and bring in the EDLs, XMLs, but I still think artists need something on each machine to be able to see where their comp shot sits in the edit, which I thought that would be.
That's the thing about it, isn't it? You have this, theoretically, you have something that, you know, could say be around the, I don't know, whatever, it's a couple $1,000s.
Yeah.
But it's a product that necessarily you wouldn't need to buy for every workstation. If you're just going to prep stuff to send it out to artists, you don't need to do anything else. Every single license of Nuke wouldn't need it. But I think to your point that you mentioned that comes in handy, this idea of being able to kind of play the timeline and see things in context. Maybe not necessarily do all that other stuff. But
yeah, I think the workflow where they're aiming it at and what they've already kind of presented on their website is if you're into commercials or long-form mm-hmm. drama, the artist on a film wouldn't need it. They can right. flip book. It's no interest whatsoever either side. They might not even be allowed to see the shots either side. But when you're working on a commercial, a Nuke artist in our studio, they're quite involved in all the shots. They know the deal, so they want to see it inside the edit. And in a TV drama, even long form stuff that we do for the BBC, it's really important for them to see the edit either side. And if there's only one sweep because it's thousands of dollars, I can't afford to put that in. And we've already got scripts. I talked to Matt Pleck. We've already got scripts that do that, but without a UI. So that's automatically done for us already. So
right.
it's more of interest if it makes it easier on one sweep, but still a locked version would be on each suite.
And so, but the idea of, say, just a player that you could view it in context would be enough, you think, or something with some similar modification?
No, it's just locked in. They load up the project. They can't do any exports or anything. It's their one clip, but
right.
the hero project, the timeline bit, they can scrub it, and it'd be as simple as that. And I think they'd sell a lot of them then.
Now, Jeff, Mike and I were talking about this. I saw it earlier this year on a trip to London, and then we saw it again at SIGGRAPH. They made a lot of progress, and Mike and I walked away saying, man, if there's anything that you... And I and Jeff, this is something that we've been looking for years and years.
Absolutely. When I first heard about this, I was thrilled because I was probably at that exact moment conforming something on the flame and prepping it for Nuke artists. So, you know, this is something that I deal with every day. And, you know, the good thing is I think that the Foundry, that this what they've shown us so far is kind of what they've thought of so far. And it was clear at the show that they're getting a lot of feedback. So I could see them answering your question. I could see them, you know, they really want to talk to the users and see what they're looking for. But, I mean, the fact is they've already said that you can conform the spot. You can then, you know, write out symbolic links to the conform and give those to the artist to start doing the comps, and then the comps can come back in as takes. So, I mean, I don't see there wouldn't be any reason why that couldn't be, you know, written out in a way that the other Nuke artists could see it. I mean, it seems potentially
like
an option. I mean,
yeah.
you know, I mean, I currently create Nuke conform scripts for almost every job I do myself, that conform the spot, so that at the end of the day, anybody can run that conform and see the latest cut. So, this is the kind of feedback they're going to need and they're going to want.
Yeah, I think they're going to get a lot of feedback, and I think the advantage with Hero is because through Python and the scripting and Nuke's so open, that Hero will be so customizable.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions to be figured out, a lot of things to play with and practice, you know?
Okay, so what do you think it has to, I mean, like, is there something that you think it's just absolutely got to have that you aren't necessarily, I mean, can you think, is there something like that, or?
Well, the conforms anymore have become very messy. I mean, 90% of conforms still, in my world, end up starting off with an EDL, which really cracks me up with, 1970s technology, and that's as good as we can do, Avid tried to do AAF, and, right now, out of an Avid, if you try to get a conform from an AAF file, sometimes it works great. Sometimes the speed changes don't translate and screw up the time base of the whole thing because of the way I was explained to me that the time warps are nested inside. If there's multiples in there, it changes the frame rates, and it gets confused, so that you end up, that doesn't work properly. You can't count on it. Final Cut XML, that's been pretty reliable. A lot of people have done well with that. But who knows what's going on with that? I mean, that whole world is kind of up in the air right now. I mean, we're still getting some, and we're still getting it. But at the end of the day, we almost always ask for EDLs at the same time, no matter what, because you just never know. Or you need to modify the naming convention inside the AAF because of some weird problem.
Is it where your final conform's done? If you're talking about, I mean, Matt talks about, opening up to After Effects because you do your end plates or your subs and your legals in After Effects and you can bring that in. Do you actually do your final master in Hero?
I don't think so.
Will it read your movements that you've got in the Avid and Final Cut where your offline editor zoomed in and done a slight move left to right and you render that in Hero? Do you render it in Nuke? Or do you still go back out to a Flame or back out to Resolve or whatever Adobe you're going to make?
At this moment, the way I look at it is you're going to conform, you're going to put the plates online using Hero. And you're going to create Nuke scripts for your Nuke artists. I mean, the idea you'd be using this is if you're a Nuke facility, you're using a heavy amount of Nuke. And then those plates would be online, which would be very intelligent, the way they showed in the video we did in the FX Guide TV, where it's all symbolic links with the rights ins and outs and all that kind of stuff, building Nuke scripts to start your project. And then I think from there, you could take the finished timeline then as the Nuke comps start coming in from the artists. I would imagine you'd put out DPX frames with handles and an EDL that points to the right places of those, and that's how you do the final conform in whatever your choice is, Flame or.
I have to say in TV, maybe it's in conversation with them, is it's very clear that they're prepping it for VFX and they would prep it for finishing. In other words, the idea is you wouldn't be finishing it within Hero. And I do think you mentioned Nuke, but I do think there's applications in. If you're using After Effects or other varieties, it doesn't have to be Nuke. I mean, Python scriptability is sometimes a cop-out that you can create your own features. We can do that. Just write a Python script. But there is certain truth to that. I think it will be useful in facilities that aren't entirely Nuke-based or hybrid.
Well, After Effects has the same problem. Yeah. I mean, issues as a Nuke conform, you don't want the Nuke artist or the After Effects artist sitting there trying to figure out the cut. You want them to start with, here's your base plates, and you start working.
Yeah. I mean, they could have an amazing, they said, in the presentation that it's as big as Nuke for them, this. They see the way it's going.
Yeah.
If they've got hooks into all the main apps that we use, this is what we've been waiting for the past 10 years, something that ties all this software together. It's not just, we still have to have After Effects. I'm sorry, Flame doesn't do everything, or it's quicker, or it's cheaper to do After Effects. We, as artists, we still need something that just sits in the middle that ties it all together, and I think this could be it.
I found it quite interesting. I had to use it in the interview with Steve Roberts in FX Guide TV about comparing it to Flame. So I think they've made a very clear line in the sand in the Foundry that they're not going to do the effects within Hero. I do think they could stand to do some vertical compositing, some rough repos. I'm not talking keying. I'm just saying layout, pull, motion,
data
in. Yeah,
they have plugins from Storm that they could put in Hero, but it's like we've got other stuff to concentrate on first.
Even just conforming. I mean, you have to conform stuff that's going to have speed changes you're going to have to match, and the offline's going to have repositions in it. You're going to have to match those. Yeah. And it's really hard to eye-match stuff or double-check stuff anyway.
But versioning as well. Versioning commercials, like if you've got an English, Scottish, American version of a commercial. And I think it shows that they've not just got rid of Storm very quickly and put this together and thought, okay, people have been asking for media management for ages, let's build it. The fact that they've actually thought, okay, versions, That's a bit of a daft way, because your clients ask for versions, so they've already thought of having snapshots and takes as your different versions, and thought of the naming conventions, what the artists call a snapshot, and it's a different take, and a version is a version that a client sees of the final thing.
Right.
They've actually thought about this for a long time.
Yeah, it's clear.
And I think, you know, and if it bears it up in what Ion announced here at the show, which is Generation, which has been out for, you know, a while now, but they introduced Generation AM, which is a different version of their Generation product, which has less of those kind of creative type features that you need to worry about compositing and so forth. What they're seeing as well from their clients is not a need to do that type of thing where you're doing effects or keying or compositing at the conform state, but just getting the elements ready, being able to see your shot in context, and have things working, because Generation is what priced around Generation AM is at $9.95 for a license, and that's getting right down to the range that you could still low price, you maybe have it on every single workstation. But what they're seeing is exactly that idea of not doing that type of flame type finishing work within it, but simply as a workflow tool within a Fusion facility.
I think it's almost a kind of a way that Red have approached everything, doing the Scarlet and the Epic. It's build the monster first and then build the smaller ones. You know, they bring out Hero and it does everything. I think there will be such a call for a product, and as a company they could actually make money and sell it, which will help the R&D to do a cut down version that is just the player.
Yeah,
I think that's a possibility.
So again, two companies, both with visual effects, both having these updates and so forth. In the case of Ion with Generation AM, and Hero from the Foundry, I think is interesting. There's obviously a need for this type of product.
I think a lot of people have been asking for it. I think I asked Matt Pleck about, he says, what could we do for you in Nuke now? And I said media management, and that was in 2007. But that's coming from Flame, and being able to comp, but just being able to just pop back out and just play with your clips and just check if it's right in the comp and in the edit, in the context of it, and get back out. And finally they've done it, and I think it's going to be a really good product.
Yeah, as a compositing standpoint and product standpoint, I think, you know, Autodesk, we showed a couple months ago in FX Guide, or a month ago in FX Guide TV, kind of what they were showing here at IBC, so we didn't have an episode with that, so you want to check that out. Adobe was here, but again, they don't have any kind of major release at this point in time, so really nothing from a standpoint of, you know, software application.
The Adobe story for me was interesting.
Yeah.
They're syncing the actual script with your audio seemed to be very quick. It was, you know, Jason doing his high kicks and stuff, but they did an audio analysis, synced it with the script. The script was already in the metadata from Story, and every time the guy even paused talking, the highlighting of the script inside of After Effects was there. It did the pause. It's like that metadata for years to come is so handy to have.
And they're really behind. I got to say, they're really, while I think, you know, the Story doesn't have the buzz right now, but they really know where that, having that metadata throughout the entire process from script creation and tracking of elements to finish is really big. And
but I think with the
feature films, right, that's actually critically important in tracking.
Oh, massively,
those stuff.
Yeah.
Did they show Carousel at all here? I doubt it. No, I haven't heard much about it.
No, but that's stills.
Yeah, yeah,
stills,
I know.
Based,
no, but it just kind of makes you think about things.
Well, I turned around to them because I went to the stand and saw them and just said, you know, what are you doing with Iridis and how much can you tell me and how much can't you tell me? And I said, you know, maybe you could do this, maybe you could do that. It'd be very cool. But then I was saying, someone mentioned Carousel to me, and so I said, well, so what's to stop me using, it's just still images. And it was like, yeah, so I can use DPX image sequences on there, and in theory.
Interesting.
So who knows where they're going to go with that one.
Glad you brought us the Iridis thing, which it was interesting seeing the tweets come out when they announced that on Friday. You know, first you had the hardcore speed grade users going, oh, you know,
what are you
going
to do with it?
Yeah, what are you going to do with it? Adobe's going to ruin it, blah, blah, blah. But it really fits in naturally with a gap, frankly, in the Adobe product line. You know, having that grading.
Since the demise of Final Cut Studio 3, if you look at production, the whole production suite, and you add any kind of speed grade or whatever they're going to do with it in there, there isn't another suite out there now that does it.
No, and
unless you go to Flame Premium, no one else has a suite.
No, the reason they're
Autodesk don't have one going from Story either.
Yeah,
all the way through.
Yeah, and basically what the speed grade users want is they don't want what happened to Final Touch to happen when Apple bought it, which became a product that just basically floundered, frankly.
Yeah, they stripped it out, floundered, dropped it now. But yeah. I think if people look back in history, I think someone tweeted it a while ago, was, you know, look at Adobe, they bought After Effects.
Yeah.
And it's still a product now. They just made it work, and they've kept on generating it.
And those guys at Iridis are really smart, and they're doing some really cool stuff. I mean, really, from a technical standpoint, very strong. And one big area that I have a problem with the Adobe stuff is they do color really well between their products with the color profiles, a macro reading, but putting those in a facility, and especially a feature film facility, is not. I mean, all the stuff you do in After Effects is kind of workaroundish in ways and so forth, and yeah. Premiere. And I think that they really have the possibility, and are, you know, Bill Roberts mentioned that they're really behind supporting Aces and so forth. And I think that's another area that they can kind of help out.
Well, I think it was at NAB over some beers we were talking about the fact that, you know, I mean, we shoot with Canon cameras, and Mike, obviously, a lot with the Epic. And Mike's shooting stills and moving with the Epic, and we're shooting stills and moving with the Canon stuff. And you end up, there's the lines are getting pretty sloppy and blurred. And the idea of being able, you know, on set, I mean, we work with Lightroom or Aperture or whatever all the time, being able to grade stills and set things up that they can be passed along possibly. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities.
Actually, Lynn Kleiser was the one, the founder of Iridis, who brought up Lightroom in my interview, which I love grading in Lightroom. I like using Lightroom. I like that paradigm. He's the one who brought that up as something interested that they're kind of interested in.
Oh, good. I was leading you because I wasn't sure if it was on camera or off camera. So I'm glad it was on camera. Okay,
well,
good.
Well, Lightroom is an amazing app. I've actually... A commercial we did about a year ago, I actually spat that out as DPXs from After Effects and then put them just as still frames into Lightroom and graded it in Lightroom, because some of the sliders that they've got in there and some of the tech that they've got in Lightroom is just like, that so needs to be in a grading app.
I agree. I'm totally with you on that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the comfort level I have in Aperture and presets that I've built for myself, or Magic Bullet looks... you know, things like that that I'm used to as tools using all the time that I don't have access to.
Well, some of the tech that they've got that they could apply stuff to in Lightroom. I was talking to Steve, and in Lightroom,
Steve,
you know,
Ford, right?
Yeah, yeah, you know, you can paint a map, mm-hmm. and you go into like Resolve or Lustre or whatever, and you can do your shape, circle, window, curve. But in Lightroom, you can paint it. But they've got the tech from After Effects where you can go in your grading suite, you can paint someone's eye. And then they can put a stabilized warp around that and then track that in there. So in the DI, you could actually just paint where you want your grade to be. They've got so much tech in Lightroom they need to open up.
Yeah,
I think the Iridis guys are going to help on that. It'd be very cool.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, so from a software standpoint, but my question is, where the fuck are all the Thunderbolt peripherals? I mean, they announced this stuff. The Promised Land.
I think no one's bringing out Thunderbolt
stuff.
Jeff,
can you hold my mic? I really want to drink a beer.
Okay, sure.
I think the problem with the Thunderbolt stuff, personally, all I've heard from the stands is, well, yeah, we'd build it, but we can't get the cables. Because you've got to buy the cables from Apple. I mean, we've bought two Pegasus units just to try out on IMAX, and they're amazing. But we had to go on the Apple Store and buy the
Really?
Thunderbolt.
I didn't know that.
They don't ship with the cable. So you buy Thunderbolt products currently.
Okay, but in fairness, one of the reasons they do that is I mean, it's a joke, but just charge more for your product because they have to put the chips in the cable, right? That's the reason why the cables aren't generally bundled with things, right?
No idea.
Yeah, I mean, basically the connector, the Thunderbolt connector.
There's a little chip in the end of the cable in the white block.
Yeah, so in the end of the Thunderbolt cable, the reason they're so expensive is because they actually contain controller chips or some kind of chip that actually helps manage bandwidth and traffic and so forth. So it's not quite as simple as having a cheap USB or even a monster USB cable if you want to waste your money on that. You're going to have to do that with Thunderbolt because of the technology. So that, I mean, they could either raise their price $69 on a product, but from a manufacturer standpoint, I think what they want to... HP's not even providing I shouldn't say that, but some monitor companies aren't even providing DVI cables with a monitor at times to save money to make their prices look cheaper.
Yeah.
So
that's
why I think...
But I think that all ends at the end of this year, doesn't it?
What's that?
Apple don't have... complete rights over making the cables.
But it's, again, I think it's more of a technology issue of the chip being part of the cable than necessarily license agreements per se, I guess, is my understanding of it, at least in what we've asked.
But there are more Thunderbolt stuff. There's more Thunderbolt stuff coming out now since the show. Matrox, Atto, they're all showing what they're intent on doing.
And one of the cool ones was Sonnet Technologies showing their half height or whatever, hat width, whatever, half size PCIe expander as well, full size, where they had a red rocket card in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think before the show, we came to, I knew that they were going to do Sonnet was going to do the Thunderbolt 2 Express card, which I thought was interesting. I'm not a big fan of Express cards, but at least it was, you know, a way if you had an old laptop and you had some Express card stuff and you wanted to use it. But then we were talking to Ted on the Red booth, and he was saying that, you know, in his demo, he did done a presentation with a laptop, a Promise RAID on Thunderbolt, a Red Rocket card in this Sonnet PCI box, mm-hmm. and a 2K monitor. It was also a Thunderbolt. I don't know what monitor that was.
I'm not sure for sure if the Thunderbolt was the 2K monitor. I'm not sure.
They said that a couple
times. They're probably pulling the monitor out of the Red Rocket card, I'd imagine. But,
oh, maybe so. That would make more sense.
Yeah, but I think one of the main things was that I think there's a misconception that Red was doing this Red Rocket Thunderbolt version. That's not the case. It was actually Sonnet who's Sonnet done this 1-0. Expander. But that's, I love that idea of the idea of, I hate traveling all the time with the Mac, the heavy MacBook. It's like, theoretically, you could have a MacBook Air with, you know, external drives or with, say, the new IOX, I forget, the one, AJA Thunderbolt capture device.
XT.
XT. But, you know, with a Red Rocket card Thunderbolt, you know, through the PCI Thunderbolt thing attached to storage, your throughput's got to be fantastic on that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's Thunderbolts times 4 currently, but it would be times 16 when it's optical. But the speed we're getting on the times 4 is just insane. And you can daisy chain 6 devices. I mean, you can get, you've got 2 Pegasus linked together, then you've got the Blackmagic in out card as well. It's pushing SDI in and out, and the RAIDs are giving 800 megabytes a second as well. It's really good technology.
Well, the one thing that when we were talking to the guy, Robert Farnsworth at Sonnet, he was telling us that the their device had a loop through for the Thunderbolt.
Yeah,
and he said that's very
express. Then out again.
Yeah, but he said it's very unusual, and that was where it was, right? It was.
Well, it's or AJA, but the fact is that it does provide an extra level of complexity that you have to manage. I mean, it's kind of not a cop out, but it's an easy way out to have a single Thunderbolt connector because you're assuming you're at the end of the channel. You don't have to deal with any of the technical parts of making sure that you are a happy and well-rehearsed citizen within that chain. So
I apologize. It wasn't Farnsworth. You're right. It was at Aja Booth.
Yeah. And so anyway, but we did catch up, actually, and I thought it would be interesting on a couple more products or some more information from Sonnet, since they, at least from a peripheral and adapter standpoint, kind of seem to be leading the push into Thunderbolt. We talked to Robert Farnsworth, so let's go ahead and cross that interview now.
Well, Apple was pushing the leading edge of the technology, developing it, co-developed it with Intel, and I think that Apple wanted to have an installed base of machines out there that could run Thunderbolt, so when the peripherals were released, then the machines would be ready.
So, kind of approach it from a couple places. I think what's interesting from our standpoint is field production and the Thunderbolt possibilities that get opened up and using that. One of those is the Red Rocket card in the PCI expansion. Can you kind of walk us through that?
Right. Well, Thunderbolt is basically a way to get PCIe out of the of a laptop or a machine that's not a Mac Pro into an expansion chassis. So anybody that needed a Red Rocket on a set needed to drag a case with a Mac Pro in it previously. But now they can take a MacBook Pro and this small expansion chassis that has one PCI 4-lane slot that will fit a Red Rocket. And via Thunderbolt, you plug it into your MacBook Pro, and now you have the same capability that you had with a Mac Pro with a Red Rocket inside.
But not exactly the same capability in remote unit, because there are third-party companies that have made remote Red Rocket units, but those also use the PCI Express slot. Using Thunderbolt actually is higher bandwidth, right?
That's correct. The PCI Express slot had been a single-lane PCI 1 expansion chassis technology, but the Thunderbolt technology is 4-lane PCI 2, which gives you much higher bandwidth, and the Red Rocket card needs that higher bandwidth to operate it at full resolution.
And then taking that step further, you can actually also, with this, unlike that, attach, say, some external storage on the same Thunderbolt port.
Oh, that's correct. The demo that Red was running in the big theater had Thunderbolt from a MacBook Pro to an SSD Thunderbolt storage, daisy chained to a Red Rocket in a Sonnet expansion chassis, and daisy chained to a video monitor through Thunderbolt on the second channel dedicated to video. So the system was taking reading 5K off the SSD, sending it to the Red Rocket for debarring that then came back to the Mac and was sent out to the video in displayed in 2K without dropping any frames.
Okay, so sticking with remote, you've also have an Express Card Thunderbolt adapter. Why don't you talk about that? Give us a description of that.
Well, the Apple is going in the direction. If you look at the MacBook Airs, it doesn't have any connectors except Thunderbolt and one USB connector, and that's not enough bandwidth or connectivity to do much. It's not even FireWire 800 or Gigabit Ethernet.
Why don't we stick with remote units and notebook computers, and you have a nice new Express Card Thunderbolt adapter.
Right. The reason is that Apple is going away from putting a lot of connectors. If you look at the MacBook Air, it only has Thunderbolt plus USB, and that's not high-speed connectivity except through Thunderbolt. So we're introducing at the show and delivering next month a Thunderbolt adapter for any Express Card 34. So in the slot, you can put eSATA, USB 3, FireWire 800, Gigabit Ethernet, compact flash readers, and potentially Sony S-by-S cards in a direct reader that's $149 retail.
Well, I think another interesting aspect of Thunderbolt technology, as evidenced in your expansion chassis, is this idea of not having to have a big main computer like the Mac Pro. You can actually do some interesting things with, say, a Mac Mini or even an iMac and the Thunderbolt X server that you've created as well.
Right. Well, we've been shipping for a while a product called the Rack Mac Mini, which allows you to take a couple of Mac Minis and rack them in one U. And we've modified that a little bit, so you have one Mac Mini on one side with airflow management, power switch in the front, USB port to the front. And on the other side, we put our Thunderbolt to PCIe adapter, so you can put a full performance four-lane PCIe card. So now you can make in one U the equivalent of a, for example, a metadata server for XSAN. So you have Mac Mini, Thunderbolt to the PCIe a slot that could have a dual channel fiber channel, for example, and then you can daisy chain from that to Gigabit Ethernet or to get two Gigabit Ethernet slots. So, and there's lots of other possibilities as well. Virtually any PCIe card, it can be high performance RAID card for extra storage, for general purpose file storage, or 10 Gigabit Ethernet, or any video capture cards. So in the field, you can rack up a video capture system with a Mac Mini and a PCIe card.
I'm sorry, it was not Robert Farnsworth who said the thing about the loop through. It was when we were talking to AJA about their IOXT. It actually has a loop through, and they were saying that it took them a lot of engineering to do that loop through, like John was saying, because of the complexity of it, and it's why you're seeing so many dead ends. Boxes with just one Thunderbolt thing, which is going to be a problem down the line. I guess they'll make Thunderbolt hubs eventually, I guess.
Well, I'm hoping there'll be a Thunderbolt switch at some point, which would be very nice.
So, Simon, actually, you saw some interesting stuff, I think, at the show. You know, everyone's talking about the new Sony monitors as well.
Yeah, we're looking at putting the new PVMs in, that he's been raving about. Which,
Mike.
A lot of people that have actually seen them, ones that have been shipped that are demos, because the BVM's out there and being demoed around, I think there's just a couple of PVMs, and a lot of people that I respect have been like, it's 10% nearly there from a BVM, but the price is like $3,500 plus VAT, so $4,500. But what I liked, I went up to Sony stand and talked to one of the guys, and he took time to talk to me, and they actually had a middle version. So they've got the BVM-E, BVM-F, which is the new model, than the PVM. And basically the new F is the PVM, but it has a couple of the options of the new top-of-the-range BVM, but not 2K. So it does all your DCI stuff. It's got all the boards. You can do your expanders on the top, so you've got your control panel that you can link together. And I think that's going to start about 15 or 17.
Does it have the consumer crap monitor emulation mode?
I think it's got S-Video out.
Well, here's my question. Has this ship sailed? I mean, is this too little too late? I mean, when Mike talked to the guy from Sony on the podcast on the RC about the OLED monitors and the PVMs, I was sitting there going, I haven't been in a suite with a broadcast monitor. I haven't seen a suite with a real broadcast monitor in years.
I've seen some high-end suites in London. that basically they're grading off plasmas.
Sure.
And they haven't got even a BVM in there.
No, exactly.
I mean, some of that's because there's, frankly, nothing
well,
to do with
remote. They're remote grading, so they yeah. have to see what the client's seeing, yeah. and they're looking at a plasma
exactly.
because in the agency's well, just put a Mac Pro in there on Resolve, and it's a remote grade.
Right.
Well, they can't afford to have a CRT or a BVM in there.
But what would the option be last year? A year from now, what would your option be to a nice big
I think a lot of people
right?
are...
I mean, not
they're thinking, you know, if it's for a film, then you do it on a projector. But if it's for TV these days, you kind of want to see where your blacks are going to be when someone's watching it on their plasma at home.
I do think that.
You can't turn around and say, yeah, but my blacks were black here. It's like, I want to know, surely the colorist has to see what the contrast ratio is, what the viewer is going to see. How can they grade for what
they're
going to
watch? Well, no, okay, you can say that, but at the same time, I think the reference standard is incredibly important, and it's something that it's always been driven in the industry from the top. And that was the same with tubes, frankly. I mean, who had their TV set up with a gray wall behind them, backlit,
but
to match what you were seeing in the grading suite?
In those days, it was so far off. My black level isn't the same at home now as the plasmas we've got to work or the CRT, but the colors are damn near there.
Well, I was going to say, though,
consumer TVs are pretty damn good
nowadays.
I
have a Panasonic plasma in my suite and a Panasonic plasma in my house, and when I see spots that I've worked on at home, it's the closest I've ever come to going, okay, that's what I saw.
Consumer panels are getting very good, and I think that's the point where you can get a cheaper panel at work.
I guess my point was, I mean, you know, who's going to replace every suite monitor with... You know, like, it used to be that, oh, Shibasuku was the big hot monitor for a while, in New York anyway. Oh, and then everybody went out and switched over to the BBM 1900s. And that was like a group think thing. And I don't see that coming where every facility is going to want to go out and spend a bunch of money replacing every monitor in their suite as reference monitors.
I don't know whether Sony has shot themselves in the foot with the PVM, because it's that good. It's that close. It's the same panel. It's the same electronics behind it as the BVM. It's just the engine that's driving that panel is slightly different. It's 12-bit, not 10-bit. But there was a company behind me that was talking about putting these monitors all over their facility, a broadcaster, and they were just confused as why they just wouldn't put the PVM in, because they don't do film, they don't do 2K, and it's like, for the price point, they just wanted to put PVMs in everywhere.
Yeah, it's a hard sell, I think, and I would personally love to see a good monitor in the room. But then again, you know, I mean, I've seen things on the plasma where I go, you know, I might want to add a little noise to this because it's doing weird things in there, you know? I mean, it's definitely not a bad thing to see what the consumer's seeing as long as it's close.
Hey,
I don't know.
You were actually talking, and sorry, this will be totally, I think you're right, Jeb, but totally changes the subject. Not totally, but remote monitoring of stuff. And so, I mean, you ran into some cool stuff. We've done some stuff with Teradek in the past. We did, actually at NAB this year, we did the RC Live from the show floor with some of their gear, but they've got some interesting stuff
as well.
Yeah,
they've got a decoder that works on the other end of the internet for their Teradek key. We're putting in, because Resolve you can do the remote grading, clients are asking for remote editing as well, which is obviously, it's not as simple as that because you don't have your media at the other end. And Teradek have come out with a decoder to sit at the other end of the internet, so you can put your video cameras into a Teradek, like, you know, you can broadcast it. But you could just pump an SDI signal into your Teradek coming out of your Mac or your laptop, you know, even on set, if you've got a Wi-Fi connection, go to the internet. And if someone's got a decoder at the other end, it decodes it there, so your internet connection doesn't have to be that quick. And that can go straight to a monitor. So, you know, a normal broadband connection, you're looking at a decent 1080 picture. There's a 5-second delay, but still from on set or where you're editing, to actually a client in another part of the world seeing what you're actually shooting with a full decoder on the other end. And the price point's, you know, pretty much similar to a Teradek. It's 900 for both ends. So it's secure, obviously, because it's encoded going
right
across the internet and stuff. So it's clever tech.
That's very interesting. I know that Jason's used quite a bit of it down in Australia on set, and he really raves about the Teradek stuff. So
yeah, they were showing it on, I forget what free service it is, but they showed it. We're going into the encoder off the camera there, and basically it was a live stream on a Facebook page.
Really?
And it was just the, yeah. But you can actually embed that with their service, with the paid service, the non-advertising one. You can embed that on your own website, so you can have a secure login and username. And then you can just basically go on there and watch what's being shot. So your clients don't have to be on set, which obviously saves them money and everybody's happy. So,
well, one of the on-set things is cool, especially as we do more and more production here at FX Guide and FX PhD. We saw the Samurai, was it last year or 2 years ago?
last NAB.
Was it last NAB and IBC? They were really big here. The Samurai Portable Field Recorder. They actually had a couple. They had like this really cool tiny little converter. And all it does, HDMI to SDI or SDI to HDMI with pull-down removal converter that you have on set. It's the size, the bottom of it's the size of an NP series battery, you know, just a common standard battery on set. It includes a two-hour battery. So what you could do is actually, I mean, they show, of course, using their Samurai, which is that both LCD display and field recorder for ProRes and now it's more DNX HD. But one end of it is actually houses a battery to power it. It's got, also got a built-in two-hour battery, but the other end of it actually is a battery, what, connector, I guess you would say, and what the male side of the battery connector. Yeah. So you actually connect it into your battery slot, so it can actually power through power your devices. So really pretty cool, cheap product. And I think, what is it? It's like really quite inexpensive, 219 pounds, 250 euro, which is like $800 now. But
well, there's a battery inside, isn't there?
And the cool thing was that the battery inside allowed you to hot swap the external.
So you've got 2 hours,
yeah,
depending on your draw. But obviously, you know, you've got 2 hours, so you can actually just take your battery off if it's dying and put the new one on and just keep recording, because it'll just run through and use its own internal battery.
Yeah, so it runs forever. Again, just like the smallest variety of the NP would power the Kinect thing alone for like 12 hours. So that's pretty impressive, but I think.
Yeah, they were talking about like putting it on the back of a monitor on set where you could run SDI to it and then pop the HDI out, HDMI into the monitor and just be a little widget.
I think,
you know?
I think looking at this product, there's... they've obviously got an insight into doing other little modules that do different things on their roadmap, probably.
Yeah, though, I will just, on the record, state the HDMI out of any kind of DSLR thing on set is horrendous for reliability.
Yeah.
It's like, do not use it. Do not count on it.
I was saying to Patrick, I think that for that price point, it's worth getting your HDMI cable and super gluing it into that.
Exactly.
Just so it doesn't come out. If it breaks, buy another one. But at least you know your cable's not going to pop out.
Exactly.
Now, and it also had test signal generators, and it's like a little Swiss Army knife. It's got a light in it.
Yeah, built-in torch, which that was funny. But again, they showed it attached to the Samurai and the Ninja, something you do for, again, the field recording. But you actually saw something cool as well, which, what was it, the Sidekick or something?
Sidekick, yeah. It's another one of these small Samurai-esque kind of things that people are doing. But it's only just coming out, but they seemed quite eager to listen to users and what kind of stuff you could do with it. They've got a drive module on the side where you can basically change the drive module you like on the side of an Epic or something. So you can put an SSD in there, you can put a CF in there, put SD cards in there, Apple ProRes internal. You can switch between HQ and normal 422. And you can also put, there's quite a lot of metadata that gets stripped out of the camera. Who else has done that? Who's got, is it AGA with Epic, KI
with,
Pro?
Yeah, with the Epic, they'll pull the real name and the real time
code
out.
That's really handy.
Yeah,
really
they were actually had on display, they had a stereoscopic Epic X setup, all right? Or
the Atma with the, what's it called? The Atomic mount from...
Yeah. So they were showing that. And just to be clear, the Sidekick HD is from what? Fast Forward Video, which is... www.ffv.com. Sidekick's not made by Animus. It's effectively a competitor.
It's a competitor. I think a lot of people are coming out with different versions. I think they've all got the fours and against. But yeah, the Atmos guys seem to be doing well with their extra little converters. There was a lot of interest in those, definitely.
Can we talk a little bit about cameras real quick?
Yeah.
At right before IBC, Sony had an F65 event in Los Angeles, they announced the new camera. Not the new camera. It was announced at NAB, I guess, and they've just kind of been moving it forward. But it sounds like they've really come a long way, and they started announcing pricing. It was... with the viewfinder for $65,000, and then they've got a rotary shutter version, which is $77,000, and then a dockable recorder, the SR4, is another $20,000. So it's interesting because you would expect with Sony, I was kind of nervous at NAB that it was going to be a lot higher price than that. This is still big money, but this camera is getting a lot of rave reviews, and especially in terms of the color sciences, because I think they're working very closely with the Aces people on this. but it's 14 stops of dynamic range. They reading the press release was a little bit like reading somebody sitting with a red press release next to it and going, how can we make this sound nasty, you know, like true 4K.
Right. Well, I mean, again, that goes back to this whole idea. And you know, some people love red, some people don't like it, whatever. The solid fact is that they have completely shaken up the camera industry and the on-set production. And from my standpoint, this is one of the good things that's come out of that. I mean, Sony is obviously a huge company with a lot of development resources and money. And, you know, they're going to take a long time probably to do and adjust to such things. But this is an example of that, and I think that's good. I mean, you would never have guessed something like this from Sony before Red came out, you know?
Right. Very disruptive technology is what Red's turned out to be. And Jim Gennard even posted in the Red user that, you know, welcome to the competition. We're happy. We've been wanting this fight for a long time, so we're happy to have this fight now. So he's actually got some players. And there's a few others. I saw the Medusa camera, the MK1.
What's the deal with that?
Well, I think when Jason first tweeted a picture of it, I said, it looks like somebody put some lenses on a toaster. Because it's this little square box.
My other one was someone said it's like Wally's head.
It looks like Wally's head. It does. It does.
I mean, it's a little, I think it's like, what is it, 13-pound box, maybe like a shoebox, almost, size.
Is this the one NASA have taken into?
I don't know.
They've taken it up.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
Well, what's interesting about this camera is they've decided that they want to give you the ability to have the lenses are fixed. The lenses are actually built in to the box, and they've got their own line of 16 different lenses that are fixed. They're not zooms. And they're custom designing these lenses with a lens manufacturer, and they're actually designing them as pairs from the ground up. Well, actually, we got a big, long interview with
on the RC
podcast coming up. I talked to the developer for a good long time, and he explained the whole thing. But you can basically change the interocular from... Let's see, 38 millimeters. Nope, that's not it. I'm wrong. From 38 millimeters to 110 millimeters. It'll be RC number 97 when it comes out. We'll be part of that. But Matt, anyway, he was one of the developers. Matt Whalen was one of the developers, and he explained that, you know, they've got these custom-built lenses. They're working very tightly with the lens manufacturer to produce a range of 16 different fixed lenses, no zooms yet. And then you put these lenses on, and it's all computer-controlled for convergence.
So you can swap the lenses yourself, but you buy them in pairs?
Yes, you buy them in pairs. Okay. So you'll get a lens that's actually going to be labeled left and right, and you know they're calibrated, bought, manufactured for that purpose. And the whole thing is built to be rather modular. The first kit is being brought out at 1920 by 1080, but they've already got plans for higher frame rates, higher sensors.
What does it record to?
Right now it records tethered to the same control box that controls the interocular and convergence and stuff. Has SSDs and can be records to that. They're working on an onboard system, and they're working on a wireless system to control it, and all that's in the works. But it's an interesting form factor because this camera could be get into places where I don't know how else you'd shoot it 3D other than a GoPro. I mean, it's pretty small. Even a couple of Epics side by side, you still have a... I guess you could do two Epics with Canon lenses and get down to this size.
So it's quite small, then.
It's quite, you know, it's just about a shoebox, I'd say. That's a good description of the size. You know, like a box that a pair of gym shoes would come in.
So the lenses, when they do them in a pair, does one have to be on the left?
They actually match them to be left and right.
They're designed to be.
I mean, I have a friend who has an Epic stereo, shoots a lot of time lapse stuff, and he told me that he has his lenses marked left and right, and he never changes that. He said
so
it's very important.
So it needs to be that accurate.
He said it's very. He's got it very fine. But most people. When they do this, they just take two lenses and they experiment so they find the right combination of two. You know, they aren't doing that. They're actually manufacturing them from the ground up and testing them as pairs and selling them as pairs.
Wow.
So it's interesting. You know, we'll see how this camera goes. We got a lot more on the RC, like I said. That's where you'd probably go check out more information about it. But it's Meduza. But it's worth checking out.
Yeah, you recorded a really nice interview with them. So, yeah, I think that was great. And Simon, did you see anything else or...
Yeah, so I went over to see Caspian at Studio Network mm-hmm. Solutions to look at their new version of their Evo 3. Just have a quick check out on the storage because we're looking for more storage. And they had an interesting unit that they'd it ships with 4 drives and 2 gig ports, but you can grow it from there. Mm-hmm. But you can put 10 gig ports in there and fiber channel. But for me, the interesting thing was with their new UI... For instance, you could have editors that need high bandwidth, so they're on fiber, they're on a SAN. You share out the storage from the SAN. But obviously, you need people to ingest the media that have to have writes But you don't need the speed for the write, so you can share out part of your storage fast to your resolve, to your flames really quickly. But your ingest people, your renderers and stuff like that can have GigE, but that's actually shared out via NAS. So you can actually have your volume shared out as SAN and NAS.
Wow.
And the SAN people can have read-only that are just editing or grading it, and all your ingesters can just have GigE, but it's actually the same volume and they're not copying it across. So that's it's interesting to see that they're being able to have a shared storage volume that they can share out in different ways, completely like NAS and SAN, rather than having a chrono sync across two volumes or anything like that. So they're making good headroom on that kind of shared storage area.
And when you have storage, you need to back it up. And I was actually hoping they would announce LTO6 here or something like that around the time frame, because it's apparently going to double again the capacity of it. But sadly, even though we need to buy some kind of new backup system, we're going to have to be stuck with LTO.
You're on LTO4 at the moment, like
me. I'm on 4, but I am going to go to 5 simply because the LTO file system.
But is that there yet? I've been told it's not quite. It's LTFS isn't quite there.
Yeah, I think for what our purpose is,
mount a volume and just drop onto it, because I've got like 60 odd tapes now that I'd have to bring back in. But I'm looking at Archiware Presto, which is basically it sped up my backups to tape from 6.5 hours verification to 2.5 hours on LTO4, which is quick. But I'm wanting to actually have something where the tape just mounts going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I dropped by the booth. It's a shared booth between, I think it's IBM, Quantum, and HP, I think, are the three, and I may be wrong on this, so obviously correct me if I am. But I went by their booth to ask them that, and it seems to be that the system-level drivers are at the point where you can't actually treat it in much the same way that you do a normal file system. And they do some interesting stuff in order to manage disruptions and stuff like that. As they're writing, I mean, basically, the LTO tape is divided into sections where the first part is a header, and the rest of it, the majority of it, is obviously the data that gets stored. But even as they're recording data, once a file is written, they write file information to the main data section. So if something happens in the middle of the write, or something happens, power failure, something like that, you don't lose everything. So there's some redundancy. And then once the final task is done, in other words, once everything is copied over to the device, only then does it rewind and write the header. Okay, so basically you imagine a process where you're writing stuff, power fails, you can get access to that because, at least apart from the very last thing it was writing, it's been writing it on the tape as it goes along. And they maintain, I'm going to do more research, but frankly, I'll be honest, it doesn't matter. I don't want to buy another, like if I'm going to buy an LTO drive right now, I don't think I really want to buy another LTO4.
No.
You know what I mean? No. I mean, that's just,
I want the extra generations capacity. Back.
Yeah, I mean, so even frankly, if the LTO file system doesn't work, and it isn't robust as what I'd like, I'll still be using it for the backups.
And they'll still
point
be able to read LTO4 tapes anyway.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the reason, I think. But I was happy to hear that. I think there have been improvements to the file system. It seems to be more robust. But sad to hear that it will be well until probably the end of next year before we start seeing LTO 6 stuff.
By the end of next year, it would be nice to see LTO 6 drive that has Thunderbolt on it. That would be very handy.
Exactly.
Take note, please.
Yeah. So true. Well, one thing I just really quickly want to mention, because we cover it in the FX Guy TV, I don't want to get too much into it here, is SGO Mystica, which I think has been getting a lot of buzz recently. You probably hear about it more here in Europe, because they haven't really targeted the States.
I think a lot of big places are picking it up, and it's not like we're just looking at it. I think a lot of big places have seen the tools, seen the 3D, seen the demo guy hit play, and gone, okay, when can we buy this?
Yeah,
it's that quick and that unique.
You know, I came to the show kind of going, I've heard a lot about this. What is this, you know? And there were some just simple things in the demo that made me go, oh, that's really smart. That's really smart. One of the simplest things, it's a two-monitor system and then an obvious broadcast monitor. And with all the 3D work I've ever worked with, you're always fighting this battle between glasses on, glasses off, what the client sees, how do you do this, you know? And the fact is, on their system, you can work with Anaglyph. You can work on your monitors, and the clients always can have a stereo feed. No matter what you're doing to the picture, they're getting an output that's stable and true, so they can leave their glasses on and the passive glasses and be comfortable, and you don't have to stare at that monitor with glasses on all the time. You can be...
No, because the client's there not all the time.
Right.
But the artist doesn't want to be swapping
could do with just looking at a 2D picture because his eyes need to be rested most of the day, and he's looking at it a lot. And I think it's a really good option to... Clients can see the 3D, you know it's in 3D, and because it's Mystica, you know that all the tools are so solid that you know it's actually going to be right on that 3D monitor.
Yeah, the 3D tools were really impressive, I thought. Just being able to fix problems, which the clear message on the entire show floor was, nothing ever shot in 3D is not going to have problems, and massive ones. You know,
it's
sample,
like the new EDL problem.
It's yes, it's unbelievable. I mean, the amount of test footage we saw with cameras misaligned, mirrors misaligned, bad mirrors, you name it. It's, you know, but they had solutions for everything. I mean, it was pretty comprehensive and in real time.
And if you own After Effects, you're not going to run out and buy a copy of SGO Mystica, because the price point for a tricked-out, fully loaded system that they assemble for you is, you know, well over, you know, around the $200,000 range. I mean, we're talking a Z800 with, like, you know, 40 terabytes of storage. I mean, we're not talking, you know, a tiny bit of hardware there on that. But as we said, a little bit coy about pricing, but they basically price it based upon your application, whether it's, kind of an assistant workstation, I guess you would say, on set, metadata, whatever. I think they're probably feeling their way out a little bit through this as well. But again, I think the best thing that we said is, like, to imagine that the UI is more like a Flame type Quantel device than is some other PC application,
yeah,
right?
It's like a Flame timeline kind of esque, but you can just go wherever you want. You can go up, down, left, or right
with a bit of Haleo mixed in.
That's right. That's right. We've mentioned that. In one of the FX Guide TVs, my first trip to Amsterdam was to demo Haleo 20 years ago, maybe, something like that, which was...
You were demoing it.
I was demoing it, yes, for Quantel. Chiron, oh my God. It was a trip to Amsterdam, and I thought, how great, a free trip to Amsterdam. I saw the inside of a hotel room, and I saw the inside of the demo room. You know, that was it, on the floor. I sat on the floor, and I had some nice dinners, and the people were really great. But anyway, Haleo had a couple of things way back then that I'd never seen anybody else tackle, and that was a really clever timeline that allowed layering. And it's been not duplicated by anybody really well until now. And then they basically have that same kind of design, and I was like, oh, okay, that looks very familiar. And I was like, this looks like a layer. Oh, yeah, it is. There was a legal problem. There was a whole bunch of stuff, but it looks nothing. I mean, that's it. That's as close. That's the only remnant I can taste from Haleo is maybe the little time bar that tells you which layer you're on and some of the nesting.
And hopefully you can see that in our crappy screen recording done from the 5D, because they didn't let us have. I should mention that, actually. They didn't have screen recording because it interfered with, obviously, the real-time performance things. But hopefully you get an idea of what it looks like and so forth. And at least, so at the very least, if you've heard of Mystica, maybe this will give you a better idea of what is.
Well, and it seems like the users right now, that are the power users that are using it, are people like working on The Hobbit, where, you know, epic footage with 48 frames a second, and that's got to be just, you know, you're going to pay for the iron to make that work.
And I saw a couple tweets about it, which also mentioned the Pablo word in conjunction with it. I think that's probably the closest thing. I think I mistakenly used the flame, smoke, luster thing from a functionality standpoint, but it seems to be potentially closer to Pablo than that, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, Blackmagic, have you seen their new stereo tools that they've got in there? They're like auto-align, auto-color. They did it on the new Windows one, and it's really, really quick. It's pretty much like hitting Apple A when you're just doing 2D, and it just says which eyes you want to correct, and bang, it's done. You just hit play, it's done. And I was saying to one of the guys on the SGO stand, you know, are you going to do like base light, do a smaller version, a cutout version, you know, somewhere you can prep your 3D tools and everything? He said no, because the whole point is you just hit play. There's no need to render it. There's no need to prep it. You know, you've got these tools in front of you. You say you want to converge them. You say you want to alter it. You say you want to fix a color in it or any kind of issues you've got. It's just real time. There's no need for a smaller app or an assistant station because it's all just real time.
Yeah, it's a really, really fascinating thing. But, hey, I'm glad you on Resolve, though. I think the Windows thing is an important thing because I'm just so down on the Mac Pro hardware line on Apple right now. And I know probably by the time this comes out, there's probably going to be some new Orgasmo Mac Pro out there that is going to just make me eat my words. But
is there, or is that a Mac Mini?
It's just like the fact that we only have a Quadro 4000 on the Mac when you have something as powerful as the 6000. For an application like Resolve, it makes total sense.
I think it's a really, really smart move.
And you know, I'm admittedly not a fan of Windows, but I am a tool for the job person. And once you get inside Resolve, it's Resolve. It's Resolve on Mac.
It's like Flame on Linux or Flame on the SGI years ago when I used to, you know, literally you just type Flame in the terminal and up Flame came and you never look behind you.
I mean, the paperclip guy pops up every once in a while.
or it crashes and Flame disappears. Sorry, and your box says, I'm extremely perturbed.
I call him the paperclip guy. but I really do think it's a smart move. Again, it gets back to the whole Linux thing where you could have what was the Quadro thing? But you could have a PCI extender on Windows with
Cubics box and they Cubics. Had four GT. Oh God knows what stupid name it was. 585s, whatever. But they had four, and Dan was showing me, and he literally added a node noise reduction, another node noise reduction, up to 100% noise reduction, to the point where the picture just looked like a cartoon. It noise reduced it so much. And then it hit play, and it was 0, 14, 19, 24.
Yeah.
That was it, and the thing was just playing in real time. And he went, I could add more, but I haven't got the real estate on the screen to add that many nodes. And it'd just keep going. And that's only on four cards.
Yeah.
And there's no like, you must buy this PC or you must buy that. You know, it's the cards that are important. It's all on GPU. And everybody knows how cheap it is to buy a PC and put your cards in and stuff. And on top of that, it's only like $5.95. And when it comes out for Windows, there'll be a free version to learn on it as well. Yeah. So it's an amazing piece of kit. Yeah. I think the Windows thing will really take off. There's that many Windows users.
But Dan is a bit of a show-off. I'm sorry.
Super Dan.
Super Dan Moran, who's actually been fantastic for us at FX Guy and FX PhD. Actually, I just got a kid about that. But, yeah, I think it was a really good move on their part.
Speaking of FX Guide and FX PhD, can I just take a second and thank the people? I've been stopped. I know you've been stopped multiple times by people. Just really nice comments about FX Guide, FX PhD, the training, the amount of... and it's just nice. People do that a lot at trade shows and, you know, come over here and have that so often. So, I mean, there were a couple that just really left me sitting there going, wow, thanks. I mean, I was just blown away.
And a couple Insider members actually came up to me as well, and I really thanked them because, I mean, the whole point of the FX Insider thing, and similarly someone who was an Insider member asked me about it as well. And the idea behind it is literally to help support what we're doing at the site. Coming over here takes time, money, cost. Look at the site. There's how much advertising do you see on it? And frankly, you don't make a lot of money on web advertising unless you have millions of readers or viewers or something like that. And so what we want to, we don't want that. We want to stick to our targeted high-end audience, people who understand what we're talking about on this podcast. And that's what the idea behind Insider is that, like, if you like what we're doing, support us through, you know, it is a contribution. But at the same time, we do try and provide extra content for you with extra movies, a couple extra articles, just as a thanks for taking the time to do that, because it really is helpful to us in adding features to the site, adding articles. You know, we have writers, we added web programming guys now and things like that. So I want to thank those of you.
It's the go-to place for news, and it's the go-to place for training. You know, you've got it all in one little company that does everything. I mean, it's you know... It speaks volumes when you actually bring out a video of something that the foundry are going to present, and they let you do that before they've even presented it at IBC. Mm-hmm. It's the main place that people should be going to get the news, because you've always got the best stories, and it's honest stories as well. It's not a lot of fabricated stuff, because you've got to please your advertisers and stuff like that. You just give a straight story from a user's point of view of what you think that kit's going to do.
We appreciate that, man, and good having you involved on this podcast. So here's your $50.
It's 100.
That's right. Yeah, and if you're an insider, you get to come to a party if we come to your town and we have a meetup. So, you know, it's easily worth that much in beer.
Fair enough. Well, again, another great IBC, and as Jeff said, I really do want to reiterate thanks to those of you who come up and talk to us. You know, we're occasionally doing an interview with someone and we see you hanging out or something like that, and we appreciate you hanging by, and we appreciate the fact that you don't come in and look in the lens or mess around with the light while we're doing an interview like certain people do here at the show. What the fuck is the...
Oh, can I just say, this is a professional broadcast show. How many times have we had people walk in front of our camera, and we're generally cautious to be off to the side, and they will die...
And they're all supposed to be pros here, yeah?
We had a guy walk up and take a flash picture of our interview. I'm like, why? We have lights on. We're shooting on a camera that has...
You don't need a flash. Hello.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm confused. And and just walk up and start talking to you while you're wearing headphones about your, what are you shooting there? What are you using? What kind? I'm like, I'm working
amateur
here.
Hour.
Oh my God. It's like, I just, you know, if I was out on the street as a news photographer, I could understand it. But, you know, at a professional trade show with people that do what we're supposed to be doing for a living, it just blows my mind. I laugh, but it's just, it's frustrating. So if you see us shooting, leave us alone or talk to us afterward.
Not the self. Don't piss off Jeff.
That was quite scary, actually.
You didn't see the color red he is. But anyway.
A while since the beer ran out.
Anyway, thanks so much, everyone, for taking the time to listen to us. Again, check out the FX Guide TV app. Check out the articles online. And as always, thanks for watching and reading the stuff that we have over at FX Guide. See ya.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.